Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I want to thank you all for being here and joining us and the millions of you who are watching all over the world. I want to tell you that the reason we're not doing our show in the normal studio is because we've traveled to Lugansk. It was hit by extremely severe missile strikes, glide bombs, as well as many, many drones. And it wasn't just one building, it was many buildings. But what I'm showing you here right now is the main building. What you see behind me is what's left of the dormitory of a college. And as you can see, there's a space because the dormitory ends here, and then again, it picks up on that side. So everything you see here behind me was part of the building that collapsed. And when it collapsed on top of the students, some 39 of them, apparently. At last count, more than 20 of them have now passed away. And many others could still also pass away because the injuries have been so severe. And we're going to be talking to some of the people here who helped to get them out, the rescue workers. We're going to talk to the people of this village. We're going to talk to some of the officials in this area. But most of all, we want to talk to the people who live here, the people who live in this community, in this oblast. And we want to ask them, now that this has happened, and even prior to that, how do they feel about living here? Who do they identify with? Russia, who has now made this a part of Russia? Or do they identify with Ukraine? And I asked them to give me their honest appraisal, and they have a lot to say about this. I'm going to show you the actual damage that you're going to see, and it's devastating. As a matter of fact, it's and it's not just here. It's the administration building, the children's center. Thank God there weren't children in there at the time. Part of another apartment building. There's a grocery store over here that's completely devastated. So it wasn't just like one errant missile. It was attack after attack after attack. And of course, here's the most important question. Why? Right? Was there a military installation here? Were the Russians using this facility to shoot drones into Ukraine? Were the Russians doing something here that brought about this reaction, this attack? That's one of the most important questions we can ask. And we're going to ask it of the people who live here, as well as the administrators who work in this college. By the way, this college has been here for something like 100 years. It's not like it's a secret installation or something that everyone else didn't know about. It's an important part of the story. We're going to be breaking this down for you. From the beginning, by talking to the people here, and by asking the questions, the journalistic questions that need to be asked after an incident like this.
These images, taken from inside what is left of the college buildings, depicts a moment of horror that was frozen in time. It was the middle of the night as these students slept, when suddenly waves of missiles and drones began hitting their school. Many, if not most of the students in this building who had been studying for tests the next day were not able to escape.
As we get here, we find out that the death toll, as we're here, and it could still grow, of course, was originally 6, then it went to 18, and now it's 21. And we learned that from officials from the school who came here to show us these pictures. These are the faces of the students who lost their lives. These are their photographs. These are their administrators and their teachers. They were studying to be teachers as well. Look at them. Look at these. Look at, they were kids, teenagers, in the prime of their life. This is what this school represented. Young children and teenagers, here, let me help you, who are trying, as you can see, to become better people, to educate themselves. It's really sad to see. And these administrators and these teachers are here to try and make sure that they're not forgotten.
Even now, with villagers and reporters from around the world inspecting the damage, a large anti-drone gun is seen right there, placed in the middle of town, as it surveys the skies for another attack from Ukraine. There is almost an unnerving sense of fear and anger that permeates the small Russian village now as we watch, as investigators inspect and process what's left of the missiles and the drones that were used in this attack. An attack which, by all indications, seemed to target only civilians, mostly students who were sleeping in their dorm in the middle of the night. Ukraine, though, says, no, it's something else. They say they attacked the college town because it was an elite drone command unit. Was it? So I asked the director of the college, figuring if anybody would know, she would, right? I asked her if this could be true, what the Ukrainians are saying.
You live here, correct? You are here. How much time do you spend in the school? How many hours a day? All the time. Okay, so that's why, now let me tell you why I'm asking you these questions. Is there any possibility that the Russian military was operating out of your school, in your school, using the school or the surroundings here to fire weapons at Ukraine? You would know that, right? Is there any possibility that happened?
Университета или окружности?
Нет, этого не было. Это мы говорим абсолютно ответственно. Военных на территории университета нет.
Have you ever seen rockets, Russian rockets or drones being fired in this vicinity, in this block, in that grocery store, in that dormitory, anywhere?
Нет.
Never.
Нет, никогда, never.
So if the Ukrainians say this was a military installation, they are lying?
Да. Врут, конечно. Это я вам говорю абсолютно авторитетно. Это чистая ложь.
It's important to understand that most of the people who live here in this town and in this region, loosely referred to as the Donbas, including the students who were attacked by the Ukrainian drones and missile strikes, they are uniquely Russian. More here, in fact, than in almost any other part of what used to be Ukraine. Here, let me break it down for you by showing you this map we put together. The Donbas is made up of two oblasts, which is how they describe here what we would call a state or a province. And of the people who live here in this oblast, Luhansk, where this attack occurred, 69% of them speak Russian. 69%. Meanwhile, in the oblast next door, Donetsk, the number's even higher. There, those who identify as Russian is 75% of the population. 75% of the population who choose to speak, to read, and to pray in Russian, not in Ukrainian. The grief of losing a loved one is not something you describe, though, with maps or graphics or borders. It's a plaintive wail. It's a cry. It's a scream. It's the unimaginable horror of parents called in the middle of the night to find their son or their daughter dead or dying, and there's nothing, nothing that they can do to save them. You know, there's something about seeing a grown man cry, right? His name is Roman, and I learned he was the first rescue worker on the scene who climbed into the rubble in darkness after the collapse to try and pull out or save what was left of the students.
Mr. Antonov, I understand you were one of the first persons to get to the children and the victims after they were hit. What was that like?
Прилетов уже было несколько. Первый прилет заставил детей двинуться с места. Это самое было страшное, когда они начали бежать по лестничной клетке. И на момент нашего прибытия сюда уже было разбито здание, охваченное огнем. Дети пытались выбежать, кто мог, выбегал, кто-то и выползал даже. Потому что вот мы когда поднимались по лестничной клетке, там даже валялись обувь. Они старались как-то спастись. Много было зажато. В первые моменты мы не могли их освобождать, потому что был повторный удар. Были прилеты, и здесь звучала сирена. Но все равно те, которые были наверху, рядом, мы их старались разгребать.
So did the building fall on top of them?
Yes. Они сверху сбегали вниз.
Oh. Were you able to save some of them?
На тот момент мы вытянули троих. Они были ранены.
Children. They were injured.
What was... I have to ask you this question because I imagine you're still dealing with the trauma. What was that like? And what was it like for you?
Что вы чувствовали лично в этот момент?
У меня дочке 17 лет. Она на следующий год собиралась сюда поступать. Знаете, была боль внутри, вот здесь. Но это моя работа. Я должен был делать. Я должен был хладнокровно выполнять свои обязанности. А это самое главное в нашей работе. Здесь были дети. Здесь были дети. Тут всегда были дети. Здесь даже намека на военных не было. Это было целенаправленно удар по детям. Я не знаю зачем, но было удар тупо по детям.
What do you say to the people who did this?
Ничего не скажу. Я хочу их взять, привезти сюда и показать родителей. Этот плач, крик, когда ты выносишь на одеяле ребенка, а ты не можешь удержать мать. Вот я и хочу им это показать.
The Russian government, though, under the direction of President Putin, has chosen a different response. These were the scenes in Kiev as Russia gave the world a glimpse of what military analysts say it is uniquely capable of. The retaliation on Kiev was a barrage, a pounding that included the dreaded Oreshnik missile. The Oreshnik is a nearly unstoppable weapon, because of its hypersonic speed. And what makes it even scarier is that it can divide or multiply in midair into a cluster of missiles before hitting targets. The attack by Russia on Ukraine, although ferocious and intense, claimed only four lives. It seemed to be more of a show of force, a kind of display of what the Russian army could do. If Ukraine and its European benefactors continue attacking innocent civilians inside Russia's territory, like it did in the village of Storobilsk, where Ukraine seemed to show no mercy.
This is a grocery store, or what's left of it. That's all this was, a grocery store. If you look across the street, you see a dormitory. A little bit down the ways, a small department store. But there's no way of making something of this other than what it was. You talk to the people who live in the town and they'll tell you, this was a grocery store. All they did here was sell groceries. Across the street was the dormitory for the college. Over there was a small department store. Across from that is a children's center. And across from this is another apartment building. All of these things were hit by this mass drone attack. And as you look at what's left, obviously it was decimated. But there is, at least from my telling, walking around and asking questions, there's nothing at this point that would lead me to believe that there's anything here that would represent any kind of Russian military hardware. Anything where the Russians were basically attacking from, as opposed to being attacked, which seems to be quite obviously what happened here. The question is why?
To understand the ferocity of Ukraine's attack on this village, one need only walk around and look at what is left of it. Concrete buildings turned to rubble, metal mangled and melted. Upon impact.
Look at this. We get examples of this throughout the town. This just happened to be a vehicle that was parked outside the grocery store. Look at this. This is what's left of it. It's nothing but burned, mangled metal. How can they do something like this? You know, it makes you realize what the power is of a drone and what they can actually do. I mean, to look at this, makes you think it was incinerated. And then it makes you wonder about the victims.
This is a makeshift monument I found it on the outskirts of the center of town, where I noticed villagers were quietly gathering to remember their loved ones. I approached to get a better understanding of both their experience and their loyalties.
Is there anybody here who would prefer to be a citizen of Ukraine and not Russian?
Нет, абсолютно.
Russian.
Russian.
The question seemed to trigger a response. It seemed almost pent up in them. Emotional. We're with Russia. With Russia. They screamed at me.
Украина гордилась, что она не лезла никакие военные конфликты. Не
да,
лезла.
Да, до 14-го года.
До 14-го года. И тут вот такое началось, у нас просто глаза, ну, вот это вот навязывание украинского языка. Да ну как вы можете навязывать? Мы всю жизнь разговаривали на русском языке.
На суржике, да.
У нас русскоязычно, yeah. Да, поселом на суржике. Зачем
никто не
навязывание
запрещает.
Вот это? Вот. Ну каждый сам понимает историю, как вот женщина сказала, да, у нас деды, у меня дед, да, это самое, закончил войну в Японии, это самое, имеет
медаль. Я не имею права с флагом победы выйти.
Ну, это
да что ж это такое?
Какой-то.
Бандеру навязывают героя.
Я же говорю, спасибо.
Целенаправленно. Я наблюдала. Вспышка, и летит дрон. Сюда, сюда. Мы просто не
ну,
знали,
сюда,
что там где-то институт. То есть целенаправленно. Это не могло быть ошибкой. У нас нету здесь никаких военных. Они знают, и кто это наводил. Твари, сдохните. Мы уже не знаем, как... Пойдите на мир, договоритесь. Уйдите с нашего Донбасса. Это наш Донбасс, это русская земля. И мы за русских.
This was my first trip to the Donbass, this place that I'd heard so much about. And I see now why it's so desirable to NATO and the West and why they wanted it for themselves. First, it's absolutely beautiful, idyllic, with hills and valleys that stretch for thousands of miles in all directions. It's the hills of Ireland, the Midwest in America, a drive through Italy, all rolled into one. It's fertile, with miles of crops and farmlands in all directions. It's also mining and manufacturing, a powerhouse. Coal, steel, rich mineral deposits abound. For Russia, though, it's something else. It is now their rightful territory, both by history, by religion, by language, and now it proudly boasts by liberation and by law that is written into the Constitution. Oh, by the way, there's also this. The Russian military now controls 100% of Luhansk and nearly 85% of Donetsk, the two oblasts that make up the Donbass. Here, life, once again, is becoming relatively tranquil and prosperous as Russia pours trillions and trillions of rubles to restore the businesses, the roads, and to pay for the people's needs, pensions, healthcare, education. But then there's the danger of drone attacks from Europe and from Ukraine. It remains a threat, and it's why Russian troops keep guard in towns and villages. We saw it firsthand on our way into the Donbass as we were escorted by these vehicles with these strange-looking bubbles. The ones that are mounted on top of the vehicle, they're called anti-drone systems used to detect and jam any drones that could have been sent by Ukraine to target us or our bus. That black SUV, it never left our side. It was part of the journey that was cleared by Russia's foreign ministry for any and all international journalists who wanted to report and see for themselves the Donbass. We took them up on it. And after a very long but incredibly productive day of reporting, I was joined by three of my colleagues as we came together to take apart, argue about, and assess this story, this unique journalistic experience that we had shared. Morad Gazdiev, an award-winning war correspondent who has experience covering the war in Ukraine. Jay Bowes, an Irish journalist who reports and analyzes European geopolitics. And Chris Halali, an Iranian journalist who's part of DD Politics, a platform for international news.
So So, apparently, people were invited to come here from CNN and the BBC. I would think this is a pretty important story. I mean, a school was bombed. The BBC and CNN said, no, we're not coming. What does that say? What does that say?
Well, it says that this isn't something that they want to tell their people. In America, in Britain, that civilians are dying, the kids are dying here, because it'll make it much more difficult to justify the billions they give off to Zelensky.
But we're talking about the media. How do you legitimately say, I am a journalist, if you don't cover one story, but you cover another story?
It's a political decision. It's a statement.
But what we saw today in that dormitory where all those kids died, those are facts. The facts are undeniable.
Murat is correct. But they're not journalists. They're stenographers. They're not free.
Yeah, we talked about this actually on the plane, because this is about editorial control. You can't tell the Russian side of the story in the BBC. You just can't do it. It's the same way they're given guidelines on how to address. For example, in Gaza, Palestinians, aren't killed. They die. So if they die, like these kids in this thing, they just died. I heard the Latvians yesterday in the UN suggesting that this was some sort of accident. We just saw 16 drones struck 5 different buildings. That's meant to be an accident.
Did you see the Reuters headline? So the Reuters headline says, when it's civilians, unfortunately, they die on the other side, on the Ukrainian side. Yeah. Russia hits.
Yeah.
In this case, what happened in Starobinsk, was CNN or Reuters, I can't remember, and they said, Russia blames Ukraine for the strike on
Starobinsk. Like, who else was it? Right? I mean, but here's what's really, I think, frustrating. So today, apparently, Russia has retaliated, and Russia has hit Kiev. And they've hit them hard. Mm-hmm. There's reports out there that they've actually used in Russia. Okay? Apparently, the reporting now is huge on the side against Russia, saying Russia is attacking Kiev. They've killed 4 people, apparently, in these attacks, in these rocket attacks against Kiev.
There's no crime horrific enough. I mean, Murad has been at this a little longer than me. He's seen it all over Donbass. I've seen it in Belgorod, Kursk, in Bryansk. I've seen it in central Belgorod. They killed people on New Year's Eve. Bryansk, they blew up a bridge as the train went underneath, killed 7 people. I was there. To see what's happening today is, it's about how this is deployed in the media. Because the media machine in the West is the same. It's a part of the machine, the political machine, as Murat said. It's so important that people understand that. You cannot be an objective reporter in the BBC because it's a state-funded organization. They're talking about RT being state-funded. The BBC is completely state-funded.
But if nothing else, I mean, look, the 4 of us make our living reporting news and looking for facts wherever we can find them. And you'd think the most important fact that we were here, the reason I came here, the reason most of us got up at 2:30 in the morning to make it here, and look like we do, or I do, is because I wanted to know if it's true what the Ukrainians said, that the Russians had some kind of ammunition or were firing into Ukraine from any place near that dormitory or that college. I wanted to know the answer to that question. And I don't believe the Russian foreign ministry, right? I want to hear it from the people there. I want to ask them, did you see any firing? And that's why you come here. Not Rick Sanchez. The BBC should have come here asking those questions. CNN should have come here asking those questions.
Statement. As I said, it's a statement. We aren't interested. We're only interested in any potential civilian casualties on the side that we support.
Exactly.
The side that we don't support, screw them.
Same money that funds the BBC buys the weapons from the United States now, hands them to this dictatorship in Kiev. Same people
you
in
saw
Germany,
it. You France saw 24. It. You same. Were all there. You walked the corridors. You walked the dormitories. You saw the photos, the textbooks, pieces of paper, homework.
Yeah.
Homework.
Kids' toys. Yeah.
And then we look at the UN General Assembly, the UN Security Council meeting, and they say, it's Russian disinformation. You were there. You saw it.
Unbelievable. Yeah.
I was there 2 days ago when the kids were still alive under the rubble screaming for help and the rescuers couldn't do anything. The screams died down. 2 hours, 3 hours later. And they're saying disinformation.
There's another part of this story which I think is fascinating. We happen to be right now in the center of Lugansk. This is a beautiful town, big town, gorgeous to drive around and see it. Most people in the West know nothing about this place. They know nothing about its history, and they don't know that 3/4 of the people who live here identify as Russians, want to be Russians. When I went to this village today where this strike took place, I don't know if you guys saw when I did this, I talked to the people. I just said, who, you know, how do you guys feel about this? And do you identify with Ukraine or do you identify with Russia? They got emotional and they started saying Russia. They almost started a Russia chant right there in front of me. This is their choice. This is democracy. Why don't? Why doesn't that story get out? I didn't know it as a Westerner. I was stupid
to
it.
The narrative. The narrative is that Russia is here as an invader and an occupier. Look around you. People walking their dogs. People on roller skates.
Kids.
Kids are happy here. And
this. This part. This wasn't here before. Ukraine completely ignored. The Donbass. Lugansk. They completely ignored them.
Wait, wasn't it worse than ignore? Because after 2014, they actually started coming here and punishing these people for going to Russian churches, for wanting to speak the Russian language.
The front line was about 7 kilometers from where we're sitting now for how many years was it? 9 years?
So then it's fair to say that the war, in terms of the aggressiveness,
was
not started by the Russians. It was started by the Ukrainian government.
They started in AGO.
This was a civil war initially. This was a civil war. These people, they didn't identify with Western Ukrainians.
Right.
The same people that have venerated Nazi collaborators.
Yeah.
The man, there's been a headline, Melnik. Melnik.
Andriy Melnik from Luxembourg. They dug him up and brought him back and buried him as a hero.
This guy was a Nazi collaborator. He was out there killing Jews, Poles, Gypsies, Russians to cleanse Ukrainian blood. The bloodline.
But what did the new government of Ukraine have against the people of Lugansk?
But they didn't venerate the same people.
Not only that they didn't venerate, that in order to create Ukraine as a state, you had to excise everything that connected this territory with its Russian past. Don't forget, it was a long history. This isn't new. We're talking about 1,000 years
of
history.
This territory was much longer in the Russian Empire.
Absolutely.
I get that. I get that, and that's easy to understand. But let's talk about the practicality of what actually happened. Suddenly, we get to 2014, the famous Victoria Nuland speech. The West comes in. They put in a new government that's hateful to Russia. Okay, got it. This new government comes in, and the first thing they do is anybody who's friendly to Russia, we're going to go after you. And this is where they came to do that. Is that right?
That's right. And not only that, they go after the Orthodox Church. They go after the language. They go after the history. They go after the heritage. They go after the culture. They say no to May 9th. They say no to St. George Rebin. They say no to the symbols. They start decommunization. Yeah. They take down all the statues. But listen, people here aren't communists, but this is part of their heritage.
Yeah, but before all that was this ATO, this anti-terror operation. So we talk about the SMO, the special military operation, right? But it started with this anti-terror operation, which came from Kiev, where the military was dispatched predominantly from Western Ukraine into this region.
Yes.
To 8 years.
But the motive is what he just said.
This is really important. It wasn't the Donbass people who fired the first shots here.
Right.
It was the Kiev installed regime. Remember, it wasn't a democratic.
So I understand that, and I think most people listening to this conversation understand that. And you can give it whatever initials you want to give it. Who cares? In the end, it's this: the whole world seems to think that one day Vladimir Putin just woke up willy-nilly and said, "I got nothing to do today. I'm going to invade Ukraine." Yeah. Right?
Biggest country in Europe, biggest army in Europe.
What we're saying here is, it's important for people to understand, just to be fair, that something happened before that.
Absolutely.
That made the Russians want to come in here, and that is that the Russians weren't the ones who started this thing.
Look,
Rick, right?
There were brutal groups like IDAR, Right Sector, Tornado Battalion. These people went and tortured and murdered people, raped them in places like...
You're giving us a bunch of strange names to things that nobody knows what the hell you're talking about.
These were the volunteer battalions that Ukraine said... That Ukraine sent here when the people here rose up in 2014.
Right.
They came to crush.
Terrorize.
Crush. And he just said, any pro-Russian sentiment, destroy it, stamp it out. And only after Ukraine sent them here did the people in Lugansk, in Donetsk, pick up weapons. Yeah. Only after.
In response to this brutality, and this anti-terrorist operation. Now, because the Ukrainian military at the time was dilapidated, okay?
There was no Ukrainian military.
In the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the Ukrainian state and its military collapsed in on itself, right?
So the Russians came here in defense of these people who were being put upon 100%. By this new government in Kiev.
They ignored them for 8 years.
They ignored them, really?
They ignored them. The people here begged Russia to take them in.
Yeah.
For 8 years, 2014 to 2022, and only in 2022 did they act. And
so you're saying Putin was late to the game?
Oh, he's late to the game. Go ask anyone here. Ask anyone here. They begged Russia to take them in 2014.
But that's because Putin was a person who believed in diplomacy. Minsk one, Minsk two. Yeah. The entire Russian Federation
Make a deal.
Let's go back to Europe.
Putin, remember, was educated. He spent a lot of his formative years in Germany in the 1980s, until the late 80s.
The Minsk Agreement.
He was there. He was in Germany. He learned to speak fluent German. His two kids were born in Germany. So this was a guy who was a KGB officer, very intelligent. He saw the West. He knew how to modernize Russia. He wanted to do that. He wanted to always keep the door open for a sort of a handshake with the West. He even offered an associate membership with NATO. But he was slapped in the face.
So this thing could have been over so long ago. There was the Minsk Agreement, the Istanbul Agreement, and every time it seemed either the West or Kiev or the Zelensky government, whoever the hell it was, seemed to either lie their way out of it, walk away from it. And now we're in a place where, at least where we are right now, this is a place that's now controlled by Russia.
Yes. Well,
not just named. No. Then forget that. I know it's Russia. But I'm saying beyond that, militarily, they got it. Yes. They got 100% of this.
Place. Yes, yeah. Right? Of Lugansk, yes.
Of Lugansk.
Of Lugansk people's
Republic. The other three oblasts, no.
Not yet.
They've got, what, 80% of Donetsk?
They're about 70, 80, 90%. Yeah. Those figures. Zaporozhye, Kherson region, the Donetsk region.
Zaporozhye is like 60%.
Yeah, they're about 60-something.
But they're kind of moving forward. So eventually, the pressure is going to be on Kiev to cry uncle and give up this land. And that seems to be what the people there want, no?
Rick, wind back 4 years. The peace deal that they had just months after the special military operation started, 2022, the peace deal that they delivered to Zelensky,
signed,
said Ukraine gets Kherson region and Zaporozhye region back. You get it back. We don't want it. We just want a neutral Ukraine on our border. No.
No, they wouldn't even accept that.
And by the way, that comes from a guy called David Arhamia, who was the head man in the Servant of the People Party, in Zelensky's party. Mm. And it was Boris Johnson who got on a plane, went to Kiev, and he told them, and David Arhamia is on file, you can check out the video, saying, he told us we had to fight on, we had to continue. So it was torn up. Vladimir Putin held up this agreement, signed. So many people.
It's one of those deals where you go back and say, if only we would have taken that deal when they offered it, right?
Next deal.
You wanted to say, Chris.
But listen, I want you to know, you're educated in the U.S.
Yeah.
Besides Trump,
which, by the way, makes me stupid to many of the things that we're talking about here. Not so much now, because I've now experienced some of this. But the average American knows nothing about the things that we're talking
about. What do Americans know when they go to university? Besides Trump, Witkoff, Kushner, all the rest of them who might want a peace deal and who might want it for different reasons, the deeper structure of the U.S. sees Russia always as an enemy, an adversary, an enemy country. It's used language like evil, used language like totalitarian dictatorship, Putin authoritarianism. All that language still exists. None of that is gone.
Well, and the Chinese,
at Harvard,
this is part of the lexicon of the world we live. And the Chinese are sneaky, and the Muslims are all radicals and terrorists.
That's the thing.
And the Hispanics, people like me, we're all like dumb lawnmowers.
So let's look at this. So if we say, why didn't they accept peace? At the core, they don't want peace. Peace doesn't help the military-industrial complex.
Yeah.
Peace doesn't help the ruling uniparty in the U.S., both sides of the aisle. Yes. They need it. How can you justify $1.5 trillion budget if you don't have Russia?
Let me close with this. Let me close with this, because here's where your expertise comes in, because you're closer to the man and you've been near him. How do you read Vladimir Putin's reaction to the killing of these children? This was very similar to what just happened in Iran. We heard yesterday he was angry, and we heard today that he reacted by hitting Kiev hard. We don't know exactly what the numbers are, but he's obviously hit him hard. How transformational is this act, is it?
There's two Vladimir Putins. There's the Vladimir Putin that expresses condolences, that says, I'm so sorry This is a massive tragedy. It's awful. And there's a second Vladimir Putin that makes decisions based completely and utterly on facts. Yeah. I'm going to tell you something, this isn't a secret.
He's practical.
Vladimir Putin doesn't like emotions, feelings, when it comes to decision making. Emotions and feelings and people who make judgments based on emotions and feelings don't get to say anything in his ear.
So what does that say for what your expectation is of what he will do in retribution?
Whatever is most beneficial for Russian policy and Russia's future.
Yeah, and getting the job.
Vladimir Putin isn't about to launch 100 missiles at targets in Kiev as retribution for an awful act. The awful act will be investigated, it'll be cataloged, it'll be remembered.
Interesting.
But the decision that the Russian state makes, it's not a secret what I'm gonna say. It's gonna have nothing to do with the 21 dead kids over there. It's gonna have nothing to do with it. The decision that the Russian state is going to make is going to be entirely grounded in fact, expectations and probability.
And that feeds into a lot of the frustration people feel. They say, why don't they do something? Why don't they do something more? And that is exactly what
sounds,
I'm saying.
It sounds businesslike.
The Russian
it sounds businesslike.
Right? It is.
It's business.
There's a very rich heritage to Russian rulers. Mm-hmm. 1,000 years of Russian rulers. Yeah. They have a lot of experience, which they pass down to each other. Vladimir Putin's big on history. He knows his history. He studied all the open and closed literature left behind by previous rulers, including the Soviet period. And he knows that emotions have no place in policy.
Final question. What we just saw in this village, it was sad. There were times when I felt like tears were going to come to my eyes, talking to some of the people and the families and the loss that they've had there. What do you think in the end, Chris, I'll start with you. What do you think in the end this will do? What effect will this have on the conflict and Russia's relationship with the rest of the world?
I want to preface this by saying that I came today just weeks after going to Minab in Iran. And so for me, in 1 month, I've seen two schools targeted by the same sort of collective West.
Wow.
And it's very painful. It's very painful. It's very painful to see. But as I said today, this is another instance in a long list of crimes committed by the Ukrainian regime against the people here.
Well, we can talk about these till we're blue in the face. In the end, will it have a different effect, this one? Will the Chinese say, you know what, we're going to now back more?
I completely agree with Murat. I think it's difficult for people in the West to understand the Russian soul or psyche when it comes to this stuff. Me and Murat talked about this earlier. The Russians don't do reflex reaction to this stuff. They don't do that. And Vladimir Putin is never going to play a part in this act, in this play that's written for him in London, New York, or Brussels. He simply won't be doing that.
But what about...
But the one point that I think is really important in the whole discussion, what's happening here in Lugansk, what's happening across Donbass, what's happening in Russia, people are being killed and attacked. The whole psychosocial and economic and military war against Russia. This is an existential fight that the Russian state is. The whole
Understood.
Cohesion.
Yeah.
And this is something that is misunderstood in the West.
I get that. But at some point, there has to be a breaking point. And sometimes it's cataclysmic acts like the one that the four of us just witnessed today that move the world in a different direction because they say, damn,
I don't think
the Russians are the victims in this case. And what I'm wondering is, will the Indias of the world, the Beijings of the world, the Tehrans of the world, the whatever, Brazils, look at this and say, you know what? It's time we really full forward behind Russia because they're the ones who are getting screwed in this deal. Or will no one see that? I'm not talking about the West, I'm talking about the rest of the world.
After Venezuela, the rest of the world, when they were told that you're next, if you do what we don't like, if you go against the United States, your president's next, your prime minister's next, after Iran.
Yeah.
Attack during negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
And for the guise of negotiations for a second time. And you know what? You have a proverbial Brazil sitting there and going, do we need this? We have our own problems.
Yeah.
It wasn't Brazilians who died in that school. It wasn't anyone else. And if we come out and say something, well, the Europeans will slap sanctions on us. Yeah. For killing 21 kids, for saying something about it, yeah. you'll get sanctioned.
It's almost like they rule through fear, and that's probably the way it will remain. It is, in fact, the times we live in. It is, in fact, the status quo. Unbelievable. Morad, you're fantastic. Che, thanks so much. What a great conversation. I'm glad I've had a chance to see this story and spend the day with you guys, as sad as it's been to witness, and yet equally important, fortunately, for us as journalists to be able to tell this story and document it as best we can. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is The Sanchez Effect. As I often say at the end of our shows, thank you so much for letting us share this with you. You know that we're on BitChute, we're on X, we're on YouTube. Again, all of a sudden, hundreds of thousands of people showed up on BitChute. I mean, on YouTube. I have nothing to do with it, by the way. And I'm on Spotify. And we're glad you're there. And like I always like to say at the very end of every one of our shows, thank you, seriously, for letting us into your homes. Good night, and we'll see you next time.